Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And today, Hillary Clinton is campaigning in New Jersey ahead of that state's primary next week. New Jersey joins South Dakota, Montana, New Mexico, and the big one in terms of delegates, California, all holding primaries next Tuesday. There's also a Democratic caucus in North Dakota. Now, Hillary Clinton is less than 100 delegates away from clinching the Democratic nomination, but many of those are superdelegates who Bernie Sanders is hoping will change their minds and vote for him.
And of course, Donald Trump has already clinched his party's nomination in terms of the number of delegates that he has. But how much of an issue will the ongoing lawsuits against him and Trump University be down the road? Court documents were released yesterday in one of the suits. They show business practices that analysts say were at least ethically questionable for a school. Here's an early ad.
For the first time ever, Donald Trump brings his years of real estate experience straight to you.
We teach success. That's what it's all about. Success. It's going to happen to you.
NPR's lead political editor Domenico Montanaro has been digging into the documents. Hi, Domenico.
Hi, good afternoon.
And let's start with 73-year-old Bob Gio, who spent $35,000 on Trump University, and he spoke to ABC in 2013.
They promised me that I would be one of the insiders and that whenever Trump put up a condominium, that we would get first crack at getting into it. He took my self-respect and he embarrassed me.
How much of that kind of testimony is in these documents?
Well, the New York Times, for example, led with one of Trump's former managers there saying that they felt like they were preying on people who didn't have the kind of money to pony up to up to $35,000 for one of these gold packages, where really what you got was the big thing was a 3-day in-person consultation with a so-called expert that Trump was supposedly hand-picking. Now, Trump admitted in a December deposition, right before Iowa voted, by the way, that we weren't aware of until the Washington Post reported it, that he never handpicked these folks and kind of had a vague familiarity with some of the names. So people were banking on his brand, on his name, even to the point of playing The Apprentice, soundtrack would play the music from the show just minutes before people would take the stage. It was mandated that they do that. So people were sold that they had to do this the Trump way. And the issue for some of these litigants is they feel like they didn't get what they were sold.
We're also hearing from managers who said they were disgusted by the fact that they were pushed to sell to people who didn't have any money. These documents are from a lawsuit filed in California. There's another one filed in New York. Here's New York's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman on CNN in March.
One of the most disturbing things we found from the transcripts of the seminars is instructors telling people, you can't do well in real estate unless you have a lot of credit. Call your credit card company and tell them to raise your line of credit. And then they would get some of these people to use that extra credit to buy more Trump seminars.
Pretty damning. But one of Trump's lawyers told The Washington Post that much of what's been unsealed demonstrated the high level of satisfaction from students. Is there positive feedback?
There was, some of what was positive and the principal defense from the Trump folks is the testimonials showing satisfied customers. But these were mostly sales folks who were judged on – the sales folks, rather, were judged on 90% positive ratings. If they didn't get that, then they were reprimanded. Mm-hmm. And the biggest complaints came from, like I said, these gold – the people who bought these gold packages and these 3-day in-person expert training. And there's some questions as to the qualifications of those experts. A court, of course, will determine whether or not these folks get what they were sold.
Well, this morning, pundits were speculating that maybe Trump so attacked the media yesterday in that press conference because he knew these papers were being released and he wanted to distract from them. And in many ways, he did. You know, the battle with the press was took a lot of the oxygen. But do you agree with that? And also, you know, his backers are saying, well, wait a second. What about Hillary Clinton's emails? Are these two stories, the lawsuits and the email investigation, are they going to intersect somewhere on the campaign trail?
Well, it's hard to know if Trump actually did this purposefully to distract from the veterans or to distract from Trump U to talk about the veteran stuff. We'd actually found in the veteran stuff that most of that money was actually only given in the past week or so, or not most, rather, about a third of the money was given in the past week or so when the Washington Post had, after the Post had dug in. As far as the Clinton emails are concerned and Trump, the issue here is that, you know, the Clinton emails have been poured over for over a year. I wrote a story about it a year ago about what laws potentially were broken or not. And the inspector general said that her setup was unusual. So you are going to have a situation where you have Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have this hanging over both of them. But only now is Trump University and how Trump made his money being scrutinized.
Yeah. NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Something tells me we'll be hearing about this more. Domenico, thanks as always.
So. Yeah. Thank you. Bye.
Well, for the first time in a decade, the U.S. death rate is up across the entire population. The number of deaths per 100,000 people had been declining for years thanks to improvements in health and technology. Researchers at the National Center for Health Statistics say the new increase was driven in part by more people dying from drug overdoses. From Here and Now contributor KUOW in Seattle, Ruby DeLuna has this profile of one woman who came very close to becoming just another part of that statistic.
People who inject drugs can turn in their used needles here at the Seattle Needle Exchange Program. They drop their paraphernalia into a chute. Staff then count the needles and give out the same number turned in. Clients can help themselves to other supplies on the counter, a tourniquet, a packet of cotton balls, and sterile metal cookers.
Traditionally, people associate cooking heroin in a spoon, but we definitely want people to use a clean cooker.
Thea Oliphant-Wells is familiar with these tools. They used to be a daily part of her life. At one time, she was a client at the Needle Exchange. This program helps reduce the spread of HIV and other infections. She shows how the kits are used. She takes a clean syringe to draw up water.
And you'd put your water into the cooker. And then you would take a lighter and hold on to the little handle.
She then puts a piece of cotton in the cooker, which acts as a filter. Oliphant Wells was a teenager when she started using heroin to deal with a childhood trauma. Then at 17, her first love tried to kill himself. She blamed herself for that.
Opiates are painkillers. They not only kill physical pain, but they certainly do help to relieve emotional and psychic pain as well. It's not a great tool for those things, but, you know, we sort of do what works when we're trying to survive in life.
Oliphant Wells remembers those days. It was a hard and lonely life.
It's always, well, I better get out there and make sure that I have, you know, heroin for tomorrow, heroin for tonight. It's this never-ending battle, and so it's a lot of work.
Those days are behind her. Now, Oliphant Wells is a social worker at the Needle Exchange. She lets clients know she's been where they are. She understands the feeling of shame and the sense that society is turning its back on them. But she also remembers the people along the way who reached out to her, the nurse at the hospital who went out of her way to help her. Then there was the social worker at the Needle Exchange who saw her not as an addict, but as a person.
She asked if I was able to treat my PTSD and find a way to stop using heroin, what I would want to do with my life. And it had been so long that no one asked me what my goals and dreams were.
At that point, she was still using, but the question prompted her to imagine life beyond heroin. Oliphant Wells got herself in treatment and says once she was stable, her goal was education. She went on to earn a master's degree in social work at the University of Washington. Oliphant Wells is 38 years old, and she feels lucky to have survived. She has buried and lost some friends to heroin. Heroin addiction in King County, Washington's most populated county, which includes Seattle, has reached epidemic proportions. 156 people died of heroin overdoses in 2014, up 58% from the previous year. And according to a county report, substance abuse is both a cause and a result of homelessness. Local leaders are now taking action.
Well, good afternoon.
Speaking in front of a shuttered treatment facility in Seattle recently, King County's executive Dow Constantine convened a task force to find ways to expand treatment.
Our current lack of treatment capacity leaves at least 150 people who've asked for help waiting every day to get that help, to fight their heroin addiction.
Constantine says many end up getting treatment in hospitals or in jail, settings that are not ideal and usually more expensive. The task force is trying to come up with ways to prevent overdoses and to increase treatment providers. For now, people on the front lines like Thea Oliphant Wells are doing their best to connect clients to the help they need. In her recovery, she was able to tap into housing, food stamps, general assistance, services that have helped keep her stable. Oliphant Wells says one thing that will always be in need is compassion.
You can give someone, you know, this evidence-based treatment, but if you treat them badly while you do it, it's not going to take.
She says it's important to have places for people to go where they feel safe, whether or not they stop using heroin. That's when they need community support the most. For Here and Now, I'm Ruby DeLuna in Seattle.
Tomorrow, Hillary Clinton is scheduled to deliver what her campaign is calling a major foreign policy address in San Diego. Clinton's advisors are hoping foreign policy will be an area where she can attract some voters who are concerned about Donald Trump. Our next guest has played a key role in U.S. foreign policy for decades. George Mitchell is a former Democratic senator from Maine. He was Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. He was also a special envoy to Northern Ireland and the Middle East. His memoir, The Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life, is out in paperback this week. I spoke with Mitchell last August and asked him, as a negotiator, what would get Democrats and Republicans in Washington to work together?
Well, I'm not a political scientist, but I do think there are some things that could be changed that would help change the atmosphere. Before I describe them, let me say that you have to keep in mind that politics has always been rough in American history. There's never been a time when it's been all sweetness and light and everybody buddy-buddy working together. Yeah. Go back to the presidential election of 1800 between Jefferson and Adams, brutal allegations on both sides, a very tough campaign. But what makes this current situation different and more difficult to resolve is the ubiquitous nature of electronic communications, in particular television, the use of negative advertising, and the vast sums of money that are needed in campaigns for that purpose, and the absolute overwhelming tide of money that is now in American politics in the billions, billions, and billions of dollars, and so corrupting our society. And when I say corrupt, I mean it has severed the bond of trust between the American people and their elected officials, because hardly any Americans believe that members of Congress are more responsive to their constituents than they are to their donors. And this flood of money is being accompanied by a decline in transparency. So it's a double negative effect. Billions of dollars are going in that can't be traced, that aren't being reported.
So campaign finance reform is what you're saying would make a big difference.
Absolutely. Well, begin specifically with repeal or a future Supreme Court reversing the decision in Citizens United, which I believe will go down in American history as one of the worst decisions ever made by any Supreme Court in all of American history. So that's the first step. The other, I think, is a change in redistricting to try to reduce some degree of the hyper-partisanship that has now infected the process of redistricting. You know, every 10 years we change the congressional lines.
Right.
They've now been written so that of the 435 members of Congress, less than 50 run in competitive districts as between the parties. I can tell you right now which party is going to win about 385 of the seats in the next election, although we don't in some cases know who the individuals will be. There's some hope there, just as the court's decision in Citizens United was terribly wrong. It made the right decision just in June when they decided on a redistricting case based in Arizona that the states could have hopefully nonpartisan public entities who engage in redistricting and try to drain some of the politics out of it. Those two steps would go a long way.
Let me ask you about the Middle East, because you were the special envoy to the Middle East for President Obama. And today, now many years after he took office, and of course, each president has tried to do something for peace in the Middle East, but there's no sign of that at all. In fact, you could say we're further away from it than we were when President Obama started.
Well, you could say that about everybody who's been involved in the Middle East. 12 presidents, 20 secretary of states, innumerable envoys like myself. And the factors go far beyond just the United States and its position. Our specific mission was to try to resolve disputes primarily between Israelis and the Palestinians, and at the time, Israel and Syria. The turbulence in the Middle East is far broader than that and derives from historical factors that existed long before the United States existed. You can go all the way back to the time of the Prophet Muhammad and the split between Sunni and Shia, which was not a religious dispute but a political dispute as to which faction would succeed him upon his death. That has waxed and waned over the centuries. It's now at a high intensity of conflict. You can see it in Iraq and Syria and Yemen and many other places. So the situation, that the turbulence that exists, the rise of al-Qaeda, the rise of ISIS, those aren't related to the United States directly. Those are historical conflicts that have gone on for 1,400 years.
And you think those are stopping progress on peace between Israel and the Palestinians?
They're having an effect, obviously. I wouldn't say stopping progress, but they clearly have an effect because the tendency of anyone in the middle of a hurricane is to hunker down and wait till the storm passes and then see what you can do. My own view is that both Israel and the Palestinians would be far better off with an agreement to compose their differences than they are now, precisely because of the turbulence and the turbulence that has created. Well, look, in Israel, there's a very high priority now, political priority from the government of Israel in maintaining its relationship with Egypt and Jordan, although they're subject to stresses, but those are key to Israel's foreign policy objectives. And I think the same would be true if they had an agreement with the Palestinians. And it would enable the countries of the region who are adversely affected by Iran's drive for control in the region to present a united front. Just look right now, the central objective in foreign policy of both the government of Israel and the government of Saudi Arabia is in resisting Iran. And yet there's not a bit of cooperation between them, two people in the same region with exactly the same foreign policy fears and objectives, and they don't cooperate at all. They should be doing so because that's the real threat.
Having been out there in the world representing the United States, how do you think the world in general perceives the U.S.?
I think there is broad, widespread recognition that the United States is the dominant power and that the United States represents freedom and opportunity around the world. There is, of course, disappointment when we don't agree with them. While I served as envoy, I was twice in the region. I met with the leaders of almost all of the countries, more than two dozen countries. And in the course of these discussions, they all complain about American policy. And whenever I asked them, what do you think American policy should be, their answer was a policy that was very good for their countries. In other words, they want the United States to take actions that are favorable to them. And who's to blame them? We, on the other hand, should be taking actions that are favorable to our society and our position and our future. Now, when you are the dominant power, there is inevitably a sense of anger when you do something they don't agree with. There is always importuning and trying to get the United States to take their side, trying to get the United States to fight their battles. So I think what we have to do, however, most importantly, is remain true to our ideals, because people recognize that, imperfect as our society is, this is a country based on the rule of law. This is a country which we aspire to opportunity for all, even though we don't reach that aspiration all of the time. So people truly do like America. I tell a story when I travel in the Middle East that Americans watching on television and CNN shows up with a camera, and what they see is a bunch of guys burning an American flag. Well, if an American official from the local embassy or consulate came by and said to this group of guys, "Hey, I've got some visas here for America. Anybody interested?" They'd all drop the gas cans. They'd drop the flags. They'd run and grab the visas. But they, what concerns them, and what I've repeatedly encountered as I travel in that part of the world and in other parts of the world, is what they see as the contradictions between our stated ideals and our actions.
Senator Mitchell, I have one more question for you, and that involves the state where you're joining us from right now, the state that you represented in the Senate, and that is Maine, which is such an interesting state politically because it's a state where you have you had at one point two women senators representing the state, Olympia Snow and Susan Collins. You have Angus King, who's an independent, serving along with Susan Collins. The state tends to go for Democrats in presidential elections these days. And yet you have a very conservative governor in Paul LePage. What is it about politics in Maine that just you can't put it into a box?
Well, I have to say, of course, I'm not objective. I was born and raised in Maine. I've been so fortunate. My parents had no education. We grew up in very difficult circumstances, but I've been given opportunity after opportunity. I think this is the greatest place in the country and the best place in the world. So I love it, and I'll be very defensive about it. But it's open politics. Maine has a very competitive politics. Everybody can make their case. It's a small state in terms of numbers of people, so there's a lot of personal contact. I traveled every town in Maine. I spoke at the graduation of every single high school in Maine. So I don't think you can categorize it. In the specific case you mentioned, of course, the governor has never won a majority of the vote. One of the things about our election process is easy to get on the ballot for independents, and we rarely have just two people on the ballot. In the last election, we had three. The governor did prevail. He got, I think, in the high 40s, less than 50%. The election before, he got less than 40%. So it's personal. People expect to see, talk to, question, and get answers from their representatives. I think it's as good as you can get in democracy, and it's very, very competitive.
George Mitchell, former senator from Maine and envoy to the Middle East. His memoir is called Negotiator, Reflections on an American Life. Senator Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And last year, around the world, more renewable energy capacity was installed than ever before. Investments in solar, wind, and hydropower were more than double the amount spent on new coal or gas-fired power plants. And China, by itself, kicked in more than a third of the $286 billion with a B spent last year. All of this according to recent research from a renewable energy think tank based at the UN Environment Program. Let's take a second on all of this with Maggie Lake, host of CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Robin.
So the world added about 147 gigawatts of new renewable energy capacity in 2015. That's roughly equal to the entire generating capacity of the continent of Africa. So what's behind this and how much is this a buzz in your world, you know, the watching money world?
Yeah, it has a lot of people talking. It's what they are calling a really seismic shift. One of the reasons, of course, it's happening is cost. The cost of these technologies is coming down, whether you talk about solar or wind. It's cheaper now, and that makes it a lot more competitive when you're looking at it versus investments in traditional fossil fuel. But I think the thing that has people really excited and talking is the fact that China is fully on board now. You know, that they really have realized that the growing pollution issue they have isn't just an environmental one. It's an economic one. And we remember back in 2014, they famously declared war on pollution and started to sort of shift the resources that massive state-run economy has at tackling it. I think in the beginning, people thought maybe they were just giving it lip service. But after President Xi Jinping really stepped in at the Paris Agreement, and now we see these numbers coming through about the billions being spent, I think people really sort of believe this is a really important pivot by the Chinese.
Yeah. Well, last year was also the first year that developing countries outspent wealthier nations in developing renewable energy. Are we seeing emerging economies maybe leapfrog over fossil fuels the way they largely just went around landlines to mobile phones?
I think in some cases, I'm not sure if it's going to look exactly the same because there is an awful lot of fossil fuel use in emerging markets, and some of it's even dirtier than we see in the developing world. But it is interesting because it does mean when you're looking at building out the infrastructure that's not there, they're not locked into some of the legacy industries we have. And importantly, you know, emerging markets are so dependent on investment flows coming from the outside. And when that money's coming in, and this is another big biz, point of buzz in biz circles, that money coming in, increasingly the private sector, whether you're talking about big pension funds or international entities like the World Bank, are looking to invest in clean energy because it's part of the sustainable development goals that the UN passed. So if they've got a choice between the two, it's not how do we get that infrastructure going? It's now we have a choice and we can push it toward clean infrastructure. And that's making a big difference for emerging markets.
Yeah, so check your pension. But meanwhile, while renewables are skyrocketing, that's still a minority of the world's energy right now. And it's not reaching every sector. We're still not replacing oil as fuel for transportation?
That's right. And you've got some big barriers here. We're talking about those legacy industries. One thing is that the firms that dominate are incredibly powerful, whether you're talking about in countries like the U.S., their lobbying power, or if you look, again, back to the emerging markets, sometimes these are state-owned, the oil companies. We look at Mexico, look at Brazil, Saudi Arabia. The other issue I think you have is, you have fuel subsidies in a lot of these countries. That maybe makes it investment cheaper for governments, but you got to convince consumers who have those subsidies to go for clean as
right.
well.
Right. You have to break a big system already in place. Maggie Lake, host of CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
National testing continues to show that in schools across the country, low-income and minority students are far behind in literacy. So some districts, instead of testing more and more, are doing more creative things to get kids caught up in reading and writing. Stella Chavez at KERA starts us off in Dallas, where the phrase, always speak in complete sentences, is on the minds of the youngest students.
Walk into any classroom at Kramer Elementary School in Dallas, and you'll probably hear something like this. Raise your hand if you have a sentence for me, teacher Jorge Ruiz tells his pre-K native Spanish speakers. He holds up a photo of a bear and calls on four-year-old Jimena Martinez. Jimena says the bear is brown. Ruiz says these 4 and 5-year-olds were shy and didn't always know enough vocabulary to form complete sentences at the beginning of the school year. That's why Ruiz teaches them 6 new words in Spanish a day.
Last week we were talking about the weather, and for them they used to know only rain, but now they understand to use, it was a tormenta, storm, a very heavy storm. And there was not only rain, but hail falling. And for me, it's very exciting.
The Dallas School District decided to make this a priority for pre-K through second graders in the fall. So far, about a couple dozen schools have taken it on. Posters promoting full sentences hang in the hallways. There's an image of a hand, and beside each finger, a word reading, always speak in complete sentences, to remind students.
We've known for quite some time in education that there's an incredibly strong link between oral language development and future reading abilities.
That's Alan Cohen. He's the brains behind this effort in Dallas and the district's former assistant superintendent for early childhood education, a subject he's researched for a long time.
If a teacher says, "What color is this?" and holds up a red pen, and a child just says, "Red." They've heard one word. If the child says, "The color of that pen is red," that's hundreds, if not thousands, of more words each day of an entire year. And you multiply that year after year after year.
He says this is all part of a larger effort to improve education for younger children in the district. Research shows that if kids aren't reading on grade level by the third grade, they're 4 times more likely to drop out of school. These preschoolers now seem confident constructing 3, 4, even 8-word sentences. I talked to a few of the students so they can show or tell me their sentence-making skills.
We put the bottle inside the recycling box, and then you put it in the dumpster.
Las naranjas son muy ricas.
That's Monica Gonzalez, Isaac Olivares, and Jimena Martinez talking about homework and dolls, recycling, and delicious oranges. So that's the story in Dallas. Next, to Baltimore, where Jonna McCone at WYPR tells us about one special book helping kids feel comfortable reading.
Jane Jacobs. Jane Jacobs was a writer and thinker about cities.
This is Miss Tuttle's third grade classroom at Lake Montebello Elementary in Northeast Baltimore. Tanasia Hilton reads from a book written just for kids in Baltimore City.
Jane did not learn about cities from books or schools. Instead, she learned about cities by watching people use them in everyday life.
Students sit in groups of clustered tables, each with My Baltimore book, that's what it's called, on their desks. It's about the size of a short novel. Author Becky Slogaris wrote My Baltimore book. Her goal was to give students a reading resource that connected to their everyday lives.
All right, so let's take 15 seconds of thinking time.
She also raised the money to give the book to every third grader in the school district, including the kids in Ms. Tuttle's class.
Why do you think having a diverse neighborhood or a diverse community, why do you think that's a positive? And if you don't, maybe you think it's a negative, or maybe you're not quite sure. So we're going to just be talking.
The students learn the meaning of the words urban and suburban. They learn how Baltimore's population tumbled starting in the 1960s with white flight and the loss of industrial jobs, all in the context of the Baltimore of today.
It's positive because it has black people and white people.
It's positive because there's nothing, and it's always good, and it's a good neighborhood.
In Baltimore, just 1 out of 10 fourth graders is reading proficiently. That's why the district wants to use curriculum that students, like Darian Edmond and his friend Anthony, are excited about.
My neighborhood is segregated because it's black on the other side, and another block is white. And me and Anthony mostly play with black people.
The students have their books open to a page with white and black circles mixed together, symbolizing diversity. Below that, an image of black dots on one side and white dots on the other, representing segregation. She hopes the reading gives them the tools to better understand the concept.
I don't want them to only be able to identify a definition. I want them to use it in a conversation. And they do.
Ms. Tuttle says features in the book, like the space for students to develop their own ideas, have helped them use new words, not only during class discussions, but in their writing. And someone who knows that reading and writing are inseparable is professor and author Dee Watkins.
Growing up in East Baltimore and then working with children in Baltimore City, I've learned that a lot of times we don't see ourselves represented in books.
This year, hundreds of high schoolers in the city are reading his collection of essays, The B-Side, about Baltimore's drug trade and the city's poorest communities. It's the kind of book, Watkins says, he didn't have exposure to growing up.
I've read maybe like under 10 books until I turned like 25. I didn't understand that reading was as important as water. I didn't get it.
Watkins and other writers are making a point to spend more time in city schools to better connect learning inside school to students' lives outside the classroom.
That means a blue pile and a blue ball.
Makai Thomas, one of Ms. Tuttle's former third graders, now a fourth grader, stops by her class. He has his dog-eared copy of My Baltimore book with his name in big letters on the cover.
Every now and then, I go and finish some pages that I didn't do.
He flips to a page with one of Baltimore's blue light security cameras, ubiquitous in the city's high-crime neighborhoods.
Each blue light costs $30,000 to install. What would you do to improve your neighborhood if you had $30,000? I would spend it on redoing houses like that are condemned, stuff like that.
Ms. Tuttle hopes the My Baltimore book reminds her students that their education continues past the four walls of school. And next to New York, where Beth Fertig of WNYC visits a school where every word matters.
Berante Conde and Eleazar Rodriguez are struggling over a question in their science class.
What is the difference between voluntary? Yeah, voluntary and involuntary.
These sixth graders are confused about their meaning, so they ask a teacher.
Okay, so voluntary is when you have to do something, you have to think about it and make a decision to do it.
The kids get it right away. Teachers and staff are hoping to make this happen more often. More than 90% of the students here are at least a year behind in reading. The school has determined vocabulary as the stumbling block for almost everyone.
There are words like predict, justify, evaluate, compare.
MS-22 hired literacy consultant Kimberly Tyson to encourage teachers here to think about vocabulary differently.
Teachers often don't directly teach vocabulary. They may give a cursory reference to it, but that's not directly teaching vocabulary to get to the level of students being able to use it when they speak and write.
And that's important, she says, because a lot of research out there points to vocabulary as the number one indicator of reading comprehension. It's in middle school that vocabulary gets more complex. Seventh graders in New York may be reading Pygmalion, the play by George Bernard Shaw, or the history of the Revolutionary War. And we're not just talking about English class. Jamie Pulaski and Natalie Sanchez say it's hard to broaden their students' vocabularies in their math classes.
You need the vocabulary in order to do the math.
Tyson told the teachers that kids need at least 6 exposures to a new word before it sinks in. Writing definitions in their own words can also help.
Keep going, though. You only have one box filled in.
Science teacher Shavonda DeRocher is trying that new tip. Her seventh graders are filling in a circle with 4 different ways of describing the word objective. Juan Roland says the exercise helped.
I thought that an objective means like an object.
And now?
It means a fact.
Objectively speaking, MS-22 has a long way to go in improving literacy. But little by little, teachers hope they'll make a difference if adults and students are more conscious about their choice of words. For NPR News, I'm Beth Fertig in New York.
Neil Fashan was just 20 years old, a sophomore in college, when the nightmare happened. He was diagnosed with an incurable aggressive form of brain cancer, diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma, which usually kills people within a year. So when Neil learned about an experimental treatment a doctor was offering in Texas, he decided to go for it. But the day he got his first infusion, the FDA ordered the doctor to stop offering the treatment. Ultimately, Neil and his family decided to sue the FDA for the right to keep trying the treatment, whatever the risks. Bob Tedeschi wrote about Neil's fight with the FDA for STAT, the new National Health and Medicine publication. He's with us as part of our partnership with STAT on health and science issues. Bob, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And first, tell us more about the kind of cancer that Neil has. It's known as DIPG. Why is it so hard to treat and cure?
Well, it's a tumor that is part it basically attacks the brain stem. And so you can offer some radiation treatment to it, but it's not something that you can radiate at length because you're damaging a part of the brain that controls vital organs, nor can you operate on it. And you can do some biopsies on it, but those are risky as well. So it's very, very limited number of options for people who have this.
So what was this treatment that he wanted to get in Texas?
Dr. Brzezinski is a proponent of and what he would say a pioneer of something called antineoplastins, which are naturally occurring compounds in the human body, but which he believes are deficient in people with cancer. And so it is it's given via an IV infusion, and patients can stay on it indefinitely.
And what was the FDA's problem with it? Why did they shut it down after just one day?
Well, the FDA wouldn't comment on why. It's our understanding that that some of the methods that Dr. Brzezinski had used to handle the compounds for his drug had changed, and the FDA wanted to look into that. But again, we're not certain.
So Neil and his family sued the FDA. What happened?
They did. And they managed to get a temporary restraining order against the FDA. And when they set up a hearing for a fuller discussion of the matter, the FDA relented and about a week ago decided that they were going to let the treatment continue.
And how is Neil doing at this point?
I spoke to him yesterday. His spirits are very good. He seems a little bit tired, but he said that he is very upbeat, very positive, very optimistic about his chances.
How common is it for the FDA to step into a situation like this and shut down somebody's clinical trial?
We can't get decent information on that, but it's our sense that it is it's uncommon. You know, usually the process for approving the FDA trial is very extensive. So by the time it gets a green light, typically that's going to be a strong indication that it's going to go forward, unless during the trial some very adverse events happen.
And this also gets to the broader issue of whether the FDA is, as some people claim, moving too slowly to approve new treatments and new drugs. And as a result, people have to try to do what Neil did.
Right. And you can look at it both ways, right? You've got the FDA on one side looking at a blizzard of new treatments coming down the pike. And it's it only has so many resources to handle these new treatments. Yet, from a patient's perspective, you know, especially for those facing grim odds, you can't move quickly enough.
Well, and I also imagine that somebody facing those grim odds would say, why don't I have the right to decide that I want to take that extra risk? Because without it, I'm dying.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, the FDA, to its credit, will offer something called compassionate use, where a patient with at the end of life can petition for access to a particular drug. But the hitch there is that even if the FDA green lights that, the drug manufacturer has got to say okay. And they are not always willing to do that, because if something goes wrong, the drug approval process for that particular treatment could get derailed badly.
How often do these experimental treatments or clinical trials end up actually saving people's lives? How often do they end up doing the miracle that people are hoping that they will?
We're in an interesting era right now where clinical trials for cancer in particular are starting to become the best hope for some patients, where we know traditionally that chemotherapy has, you know, it's very proven for certain indications, but we also know the track record in a lot of cases is that it just won't work permanently. Whereas in clinical trials now with something called precision medicine, researchers are looking at genetic mutations of specific tumors, and they've found, in some cases, very dramatic success with clinical trial treatments.
And we'll link people to your story from STAT at our website, hereandnow.org, about Neil. Bob Tedeschi, senior writer at STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeremy, thanks so much for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young. It's Here and Now.